Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Audrey Dean Kelly? Do y'all like Audrey? A North Little Rock native, Audrey can be found on Reverb Nation and iTunes. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark has shared the stage with, among others, the late blues legend David Honeyboy Edwards. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set? Y'all like our set back here? Our featured artist tonight is Little Rock painter Doug Norton with his painting Rooster, this one right here, which is for sale. Our listeners can go to our website and find out more about this painting and Doug at talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? This week's stories all involve trust, whether it's being established, broken, or turned upside down. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Mike Nolan destroys the 10 years of trust he has accrued. And we'll end the night with Martha Eshelman as she puts her trust in a close friend, regardless of what he just said. But let's start the night with Jenny Carlisle as she naively trusts a group of boys she is in charge of in Perfect Weather for Scouting.
Everyone who had gathered around the flagpole at Mills Park in Bryant was waiting for the camp director to pass along some very important details about the upcoming finale of Cub Scout Day Camp. They needed to know what time the evening program would start, what to bring for the Weebelows camp out. There I stood in my pale yellow scout leader uniform, soaked to the skin, literally trying to catch my breath and string intelligent words together. It was the end of a very eventful week that had taken months of preparation. Two of us had traveled to National Camp School in Texas and returned to train the other volunteer leaders about very important things. We were motivating and instructing future soldiers, policemen, ministers, and community and business leaders of all types. We recognized the importance of making sure these kids had nothing but fun while they learned lessons that would stay with them forever. One of the many things we had to prepare for was the usually hot but always unpredictable Arkansas summer weather. I had visited with the proper authorities and obtained written verification, ensuring our safety no matter what the weather decided to do. Now, as I looked at the faces of the Boy Scouts who had caused my immediate misery, I realized that be prepared was a motto I could never totally live up to. At Cub Scout Day Camp, the campers are inexperienced, ranging in age from just out of first grade to going into the sixth. Slightly older Boy Scouts, known as Den Chiefs, help shepherd the Cubs from one activity to the next. A major job duty of the camp director was to make sure that the adult den leaders didn't end up with just one more boy to discipline. Our den chiefs needed to act responsibly enough to actually be of some assistance. We did allow them some latitude, though. The goal was for all of us to have an enjoyable week. So when the band of boys asked me if they would help with an afternoon closing ceremony by providing a weather forecast, I was happy to oblige. Having never been an attendee at a Boy Scout camp before, I had no forewarning about what these little skits were going to involve. The first day, two of the boys approached with hands behind their backs. "Miss Jenny, are you ready for the weather forecast?" They both bobbed and squirmed, barely containing themselves. "Sure, what's the weather going to be like tomorrow?" I played along. "We heard there's a slight chance of showers." Whipping out their hidden water pistols, they fired, causing laughter from the cubs, the parents, and my other so-called friends. Okay, that was actually refreshing. "Thanks, guys," I smiled and continued the announcements. The next day, the fun continued with our campers happily moving from archery to the BB gun range to a visit with Mother Nature and to the craft area. At each station, they earned recognition, a bead or other homemade dingle dangle to hang next to their name tag on a leather cord, also known as a flugeldougal. During the closing ceremony, two different den chiefs came forward, again, with hands behind their backs. "Miss Jenny, tomorrow we may have more than showers. The weatherman's calling for sudden downpours." They each dumped a super-sized drive-through cup full of water over my head. Oh, joy. I was grateful I'd not been too worried about my hairdo that day. Once again, the crowd went wild. I wondered what the next day would bring. Unfortunately, the closing ceremony was canceled on the third day of day camp. That day, we had a real live weather event to deal with. You know the routine, sunny one minute, ominous clouds gathering the next. We were on the alert for the first rumbling of thunder, which meant there could be lightning in the area. When that happened, we gathered under the big pavilion for songs, skits, general improvisation. One good thing about Cub Scout den leaders is they're experts at makeshift rainy day activities. The storm became more threatening. The local police department came to check on us. They assured us there was no tornado warning yet. But the rain and lightning was going to get worse before it got better. While the leaders and den chiefs entertained the campers, I used someone's cell phone, called the phone number on my plastic protected letter from the local authorities. Of course, the person who signed the letter was not available, but I read my letter to the person who answered the phone. The plan was that if things got bad enough, school buses would be sent to transport us to a church fellowship hall. "Oh, that's not possible," the voice on the other end of the phone seemed to say. Maybe I had a bad connection. "What? School buses don't have insurance coverage to carry anyone who's not participating in an official school function." "But I have it in writing." I waved the letter at the phone, trying to be sure it didn't get soaked from the rain that was blowing in quite briskly. Gradually, the songs and skits could not be heard over the torrential rain and thunder. The adults made a protective circle around the children and moved them into the center of the pavilion. Parents began showing up, frantic to get their children to the safety of their own homes. Normally, there were procedures for checking a child out early from day camp. The leaders asked me what to do. I thought about the paperwork in the big plastic box under one of the picnic tables. What a useless exercise that would be. Suddenly, I had the solution. "Just grab their flugeldougals before they leave." Those were words I had never planned to utter. But it worked. We could use the name tags to keep up with who was still there, even if the whole camp blew away. Luckily, it didn't blow away. The storm gave way to one of those slightly cooler, still steamy afternoons, and we all left, looking like forlorn, soaking wet hound dogs. The fourth day of camp was much more routine. The den chiefs predicted hail with a cup of ice down my back. Finally, the last day, we had awards to hand out, songs and skits that had been rehearsed to impress the parents who had not been on site during the week. And here I stood, like a blithering idiot. The prediction by our courteous, brave, and reverent den chiefs? A hurricane in the form of a strategically placed ice chest. Now I knew what the Super Bowl champion coach must feel like. I was literally in shock. Their faces changed from mischievous smiles to obvious concern. "Miss Jenny, are you okay?" Of course I was, or I would be momentarily. I'd learned two valuable lessons that week. First, always have a plan B and a plan C, even if you have plan A signed and certified. Secondly, never trust a Boy Scout with a bucket of water.
Jenny Carlisle has written stories since she could hold a pencil. She and her prom date raised three great kids in Saline County in Arkansas. A columnist for Ouachita Life magazine, she aspires to write Christian fiction. In our next story, Mike Nolan decides to test the boundaries of trust and fails in Pine Sol.
One summer day in 1970 changed my life. I was 10 years old and living a middle-class existence in Levy, Arkansas, with the simplicity and fun of an Andy Griffith episode, the episodes before color. My three best friends and I enjoyed every day of summer like it was the last day on earth. I hit the ground running by 8 o'clock and would not come back inside until my parents made me at 9 o'clock that night. Back then, summer days were 28 hours long, and we were out of school for 6 months. At least that's how it felt. We'd spend every minute of our day playing, planning, and living like vagabonds. During that summer, we had free rein to ride our bikes wherever we wanted, as long as we told our parents where we were going. That world seems more like a fantasy now. Back then, the worst thing that ever happened to kids was scraped knees or a few stitches. We would bike to the park, to the trails, and to the store to get comic books and banana-flavored bark soda. We never wore helmets or protection of any kind, yet somehow we lived to play another day. This particular day, we had been riding our bikes all around and wound up at the Safeway store. We were a bit hungry and really wanting a snack. The four of us didn't have any money and didn't want to ride all the way home to get any. So a plan was hatched, at least in my head anyway. Being the self-appointed leader of the gang, I had to be resourceful. So, for reasons that remain a mystery to me even today, I devised a scheme. A brilliant and devious plan that would prove me to be both fearless and cunning. I decided to steal some penny candy. You may be familiar with the Brock's candy displays from that time. There was a large bin full of assorted delights, such as caramels, chocolates, and those little white candies with colored pieces embedded in them. My personal favorite. There was a scoop, a scale, and some small white bags. You were supposed to weigh your candy, bag it, and then pay for it at the checkout line. The honor system. Were they really so trusting to think that I had any honor, or that I could be stopped by mere guilt alone? That candy was about to be absconded by the next great master thief. As I made my way into the store, I cased the joint, just like a pro. In my head, I could hear the theme song to Mission Impossible. Dun, 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 dun. Circling the candy bin, I noticed the butcher to the right doing whatever butchers did. The scrawny high school kids stacking shelves wouldn't have noticed me if I was screaming, "Sock it to me, sock it to me," which I sometimes did. And the woman at the checkout stand was sacking some groceries for an elderly man. This was almost too easy. I started to laugh, but then I didn't. It was go time. My friends were watching, holding my bike for the getaway. On the outside, I was Steve McQueen. On the inside, Barney Fife. This was the start of a crime spree that would most likely end with me being gunned down in a hail of bullets or living barefoot in my villa on an island in the blue waters of the Pacific. Yeah, it's safe to say I'd seen a few movies. I had concocted in my head how my whole life would change after my first taste of larceny. I'm not living life like a sucker. I'm going to take what I want. And right now, I want candy. I positioned myself with my back to the outside with full view of the store. Then, quick as a cat, I snatched a couple of pieces of candy. Pow! Straight into my pocket. This was laughable. I grabbed two more before you could even say Dillinger. Not to be greedy or press my luck, I decided to stop there. Now I had to beat a hasty retreat to my buddies. With a final glance around, I hot-footed to the door, secure in my knowledge that this was not the last of my jobs. I was already planning my next heist as I strolled out. Maybe I could start selling the candy on the black market. Or at recess next school year. I might just buy myself one of those new 8-track tape players I've heard so much about. Approaching the door, everything looked like a dream. It was in slow motion. My friends were laughing and smiling, and I felt like I was walking on air. It was groovy. I had just stepped outside the doors when a force snatched me up in the air. Now, I really was walking on air, since my feet were no longer touching the ground. My mind was racing, and I was confused. Had I been abducted by aliens? What was happening? My arm was in the grasp of my mother. Without blinking, I immediately went into defense mode. They have the money. I was just going to get it. Of course, my friends were already hitting their strides on their bikes before mine had even hit the ground. I needed new friends. Mom's grip on my arm would be the subject of an investigation from Child Protective Services if it were today. But in 1970, it was just called good parenting. Her speed, strength, and quickness were quite impressive. She dragged me into the store. "You will take this candy to the checkout and tell them what you've done," she said through clenched teeth. "What? Couldn't I give them my allowance for a month or pick up trash?" Mom placed me roughly in front of the checkout woman and said, "Tell her what you did." Obviously, all the adults in my world worked from the same playbook back then. The checker immediately adopted an angry scowl and waited on me to speak. Hot tears streamed down my face from shame and fear as I weakly squeaked out my confession. "I stole some candy from the bin," Mom said. "And?" Well, I was a little confused. The sudden end to my criminal enterprises had left me disoriented. What did she want? The names of my co-conspirators? Had I used a weapon? Did I wet my pants? "Go on, you know what to say," Mom said, and then it hit me. "I'm sorry." I dug into my pocket and fished out the pieces of candy. They wouldn't have tasted any good now because my mouth was full of cotton. The checker was as cold as a February morning as she took back the candy. My mom dragged me outside and told me to get on my bike and go straight home. I was to wait in my room until she got there, when the real punishment would be meted out. My shame was overwhelming. No TV or records for a week. I couldn't leave the yard or play with my friends. It took a year before I could enter Safeway without feeling like every pair of eyes was on me. "There he is, the thief of Levy," they would laugh. The gods had been against me that day, my friends. How else can you explain that the exact moment I begin my first and only act of shoplifting, my mother had just pulled up to the grocery store? Looking through the front windows of Safeway as she walked in, she noticed her youngest son standing by the candy bin. She watched me as I grabbed the candy and made for the doors. Springing into action, she ended my life of crime before it even got started. Pine Sol. She had to buy Pine Sol.
Mike Nolan has worked in film, theater, and commercial production and just had his third play, Sleeping Beauty, A Very Merry Fairy Tale, chosen for publication this year. Mike has been teaching speech and drama in North Little Rock, Arkansas since 1987, and his free time is spent enjoying his family, which is his greatest source of pride and joy. In our final story of the night, Martha Eshelman puts her trust in a close friend to take her to places she's never been in the Warrior Round.
Miguel and I sat in his apartment, listening to the traffic outside while drinking Jack and Coke and discussing weighty issues like whose girlfriend had misbehaved the most the past week. The conversation turned to his upcoming sweat ceremony, a time of purification for his next step in his transition to fully becoming a man. He suddenly turned to me and said, "Tio, would you like to come?" Up until that moment, he hadn't asked me because he knew I was Episcopalian. And the most radical thing I had done at a Sunday worship service was show up for the Eucharist in cargo shorts and flip-flops. I was thrilled, honored. Instantly, I said, "Of course." Miguel hugged me, told me a summary of what would happen at the ceremony, and then said, matter-of-factly, "Well, you don't have to be naked." My stomach did a somersault, but Miguel never blinked. Nothing ever fazed him. He said, "Okay, don't worry about it, Tio. It'll be okay. Just don't wear any underpants." No underpants? I mean, why no underpants? I mean, really, why? Miguel then explained that the spirit would be flowing through me, and it needed an exit point. Well, any good Episcopalian would have chosen the ear as the exit point. As I left his apartment, my mind was swirling with the thoughts of myself on a dirt floor in the dark without any underpants, keeping company with half-naked persons I barely knew, and a spirit of some sort exiting my body in a rather uncomfortable location. As Miguel would say, It'll be okay. So I took a deep breath, put my trust in him, went home, and began to pack. The next day, we arrived at the Fire Om Earth Retreat Center. Lorna, the leader of our sweat ceremony, met our group, and we went out to greet the ancestors and prepare the lodge. In the opening near the lodge, there was an enormous fire, crackling, hissing, flames licking up to the sky. Inside it, you could see the ancestors, the sacred rocks, heating up and glowing bright. It was near this fire that we began Miguel's sacred ceremony. By 10 o'clock, Miguel had finished his first set of prayers. He had blown the conch shell to the north, south, east, and west, and each of us had smoked the ceremonial pipe. The ancestors were now ready, and the sweat lodge had been constructed. It was time to remove our sandals, be covered in sage smoke, and enter the lodge. I was waiting to enter when I overheard several folks discussing their past sweat experiences. These people obviously loved sweat ceremonies. They loved the heat of the last round. I overheard them call each other the sweat hogs. I couldn't help but think that here I was, a sweat piglet. And my inaugural sweat was about to begin. After we found our seats in the dirt, the first seven ancestors were brought into the lodge and the flap was shut. At first, the lodge was dark and silent and actually rather cool. I had no idea what to expect, what I should do, when I should pray, out loud or to myself. Thankfully, Lorna guided our way through each round. By the end of the first three rounds, the lodge was beginning to get hot and fill with steam, and we had 21 ancestors glowing brightly in the middle. We prayed collectively and individually, focused on Miguel. And with each round, that inipi became hotter and filled with more steam. Charlotte, Miguel's friend, recited the 23rd Psalm from memory. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. The experience was indeed spiritual and mystical, but the heat was rising. I looked around and realized that some people had removed clothing. Others were settling in the dirt. I myself was still clothed, despite the layer of sweat that covered my skin. Though I tried to still my mind, I was full of questions. Had I in fact chosen the heaviest cotton t-shirt in my closet? Were those women over there half naked or totally naked? Could I keep my composure if that man's knee slimed me one more time? Well, finally, it was time for the fourth and final round. All things considered, I thought I was doing pretty well. I had made it through the first three rounds, no problem. How bad could this last round really get? I was about to find out. David, the firekeeper, announced he had a surprise for us and then proceeded to bring into the lodge every remaining ancestor that was left, perhaps even a few from Oklahoma. Because the pile now seemed to be 4 feet high, the flap was shut. Immediately and dramatically, the temperature increased, and I quickly scooted back against the sapling frame. Before the first ladle of water was poured on top of the ancestors, I was starting to roast, and the round had barely begun. I briefly thought about my t-shirt and how it sealed the heat against my skin. No, I would continue to be my piglet self and leave it on. Then Lorna spoke. This is the warrior round. This is the final round. You can leave if you must, but try to stay in. Roar like the lions in Africa. Howl like the wolves on the Lakota Plains. Stay in. Then she began to beat a drum and sing a Lakota song, her gravelly voice chanting out this native tongue. Steam began to fill the inipi now until I couldn't see anyone on the other side. Through the heavy mist, I did see Miguel on his knees, arms to the sky, soaking in the heat of his purification. But for me, each minute brought more heat, more steam, more sweat, more thoughts of pulling back that flap for a rush of cool air. I was almost certain that I would not be able to honor Miguel and stay in. I sat upright, heart pounding, sweat dripping off my nose. I stared at the water ladle, willing it to stop, begging for the ancestors to stop their heat and steam. I couldn't escape this physical torment. I tried everything to escape the overwhelming heat. I sat up, I lay down, I rolled in the dirt. I even stuck my hand outside through a small crack in the inipi wall. Nothing. So, with my cortex blistering and desperation mounting, I sat up and had me a wardrobe malfunction. I ripped off my shirt, flung it behind me, and then sat there, waiting for an air conditioner to appear. Nothing. Still hot, still sweaty, still wondering if I could make it to the end. I was now a sweaty, half-naked piglet. And I just didn't care. I was on fire. Just when I knew failure was imminent and I would have to leave the lodge, I heard a roar. A lion of Africa. Then a howl from the Lakota Plains. The lodge filled with their sounds. Roar! Ho! Roar! Ho! The unending beat of the drum, the hiss of the ancestors. Roar! Ho! Roar! Ho! My ears filled with the noise. My skin was blistering, my nostrils filled with steam. My heart was galloping in my chest. I was mad. But I needed to survive. I wanted desperately to be a warrior. It was then, in that madness, I found what I needed to survive. I dug deep. And when I came up, it wasn't a lion or a wolf. It was the voice of Sammy, my miniature poodle. And his high-pitched bark. It was the only thing I could do. I barked, yip! And then barked louder, yip, yip! Until I was barking at the top of my steam-filled lungs. Roar, ho, yip, yip! Roar, ho, yip, yip, yip! It could have been 5 minutes or 5 years. I have no idea. But then suddenly, it all stopped. No song, no drum, no lions, no wolves, no poodle. Just like that, it was over. The flap opened. Cool air and sunlight rushed in. And then reality hit me. Where did I put my shirt? In seconds, I found it, crawled out of the anepi, found a stump, and sat down. It was over. Later, we ate our sacred food of corn, squash, and beans. It had really been a good day. I had honored Miguel, and me, I had found my inner poodle. And in the process, I had become a warrior.
Martha Eshelman is officially an anatomy and physiology professor during the week and a writer and novice filmmaker on the weekends. Her worship style still includes St. Michael's Episcopal Church and a local Pentecostal church. The Church of Two Spirits is a new sweat lodge built in Little Rock by Miguel herself and the rest of her gay family called the Dogs. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are currently open for submissions from Southerners. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.